at session number 31558, reel 12.
And we went down to just the edge of Darfur, beyond El Abeid, and we came to the place and wanted to see where the camels came from as we went to Egypt, because they did a 40 days march down to Egypt, and there were one or two wells on the way, and not very much till they got to the Nile. Just they had to get there just before Egypt, or just after the Sudan border. Borders weren't very much marked in those days. And the people came to us at Ganoun, the village was called, and they told us their names and who was married to who and what the rain was like. Well, it was the beginning of the first drought that year, and they were short of water, and they were all saying, please tell, they thought we must be government officials. They didn't seem to have realized outside that the British had gone for 6 years, well, 10 years by that time, and they thought it was just that. And the same thing when we went to went down to the Jebel south of Dinda, Rahed. We went there in Gesna Hills, they were called, and they said they thought that the DC had been there sometime earlier, but we had the first Land Rover they'd ever seen. And there were three villages. One was called Beer, because there was a beer there, a well. And then there was another one called Aswad. Well, Aswad is black, and so they said that they didn't tell us this, but they told some people, English people from the anthropology department at the university, went down, were mixed parties, English and Sudanese, and they said it was a very dark lady, and that was called. She was called the Aswad. She started a village up there. But the DC at the time obviously had played a part in this, because Beer, if we're going to have beer, you want whiskey and soda. So he said, well, the next village was called Whiskey. Was called Wisco. They'd accepted that it had come from this. The anthropologists, all trained in English universities and American universities. But about the one called Shoda, they said it was because this black woman, they were told, Aswada, comes to Shoda when you speak it fast. And that's why it was called Shoda. But I'm sure that it was called the DC probably said, so if you've got whiskey, you have whiskey and soda. If you've got beer, you want whiskey, and if you want whiskey, you want whiskey and soda. That's how the three villages are named.
Were you able to travel then much outside of...
We could travel wherever we wanted to. And when one time they said you had to have a camera, visa for a camera, or a permit for a camera, because one thing you weren't allowed to do was to take photographs of naked women who would be southerners, you see. And even they didn't want to be taken, but they would put that there. If they only had one garment, they would put it over their heads rather than the other part of their body. But by that time, every student I had who was doing research or something like that, who I got to know well, had an uncle who was a minister or something like that. So they said, if you want a permit for a camera, yes, we would have my uncle's a minister, he will fix it up. And then they were very, very helpful, nice to us.
Presumably you got quite good at travel in hot climates and
yes.
living in hot climates.
Well, I suppose because I was in the desert, I found that I could travel in deserts without getting lost. And it was useful in the Sudan, but it didn't matter very much because of the first lorry out in the year would follow the tracks of the last one or beside it. So there were great areas of tar marks, so you knew if you were on the road. And if you got a little bit to the north of it, you'd say, well, I must go a bit to the south. And with a watch, you could tell north and south. So I hardly ever used even a prismatic compass. And the sun compass I never used at all. I took one out, but it was not needed.
Just to go back a bit and back to the war, what had been your attitude towards the Germans as a whole and the Italians, I suppose, during the war itself?
Well, the Italians, none of us sort of thought the Italians didn't count them at all because they didn't count for anything. And what we did was dislike because we knew that they'd treated prisoners badly. The Germans, when it was 15th and 21st Panzer divisions, they were not SS divisions, and they were very correct. Or every story that got back, the Germans had behaved perfectly correctly. So we thought it'd be like that in Normandy. And, well, we didn't know that it wasn't at first, except that they were fighting very tightly. And the Corn Offensive, we were told, was a success because it had got elements of every Panzer division in Western Europe was opposing armored divisions. So in that sense, it was a success. So we didn't feel badly about that. And we didn't feel particularly badly about the Germans themselves. It wasn't until they heard about Auschwitz and all those sort of things that I realized that had we known about them like that, we wouldn't have been so tolerant. The ones that got taken prisoner, my friends who I met afterwards who had been with A Squadron and the ones in Arthur Carr's tank, who were all all of our HQ squadron who weren't killed were taken prisoner, except for my crew, me and Pat Dyes, who escaped on his own. We treated them, reasonably well. I do remember coming out of a wood, and I saw two Germans came up to surrender with their hands up. And I was the only person who could see them because the turret was pointed forward. The rest of the troop was behind, out of sight. And I thought, I could shoot those two, bang, bang, with my revolver at this range. I couldn't miss, even moving. And nobody would ever know. And I'd never... And I wonder what it's like to kill somebody. So I said, go get back, because I didn't entertain it seriously. But I remember the thought occurred to me afterwards when I heard that some of the things the Germans done. Perhaps they thought like that and thought, I'll do something filthy like that. I just thought I could do it, like you might think I could tread on that snail. But I don't like treading on snails. I prefer to throw them over the wall into the gardens.
What then now is your attitude towards the war as a whole?
Well, I'm jolly glad I was in it. And even more glad that I survived it. Because all my friends were killed after the war, all in England. After the war, it was a different set of friends. And now they've all died off too. So I haven't got any of my own generation, hardly anybody. There's somebody I knew at my prep school who lives in Brighton now, and he came up about 15 years ago and we met and we had a lunch at a restaurant, but we haven't met since because there are different sorts of interests differed over that time.
Obviously there was the injury to your leg, but did you find any ongoing mental or psychological effects of the war afterwards?
No, except they don't like fireworks very much. And I have always had these dreams. Even now, if I have a dream, it's either something about the war or something about Germans, or, you know, this is something that I've got to... that I remember. About a third of my dreams, even now, ridiculous sort of dreams sometimes. But I remember once one dream I was where the road comes past the oval and you the cricket ground and you turn bare left and you go under the bridge to get to Waterloo Bridge. Well, on the right there, it was all open country, and I remember very well the troop of Cromwell's having to go across that, and some German tanks in the distance. That sort of dream is unusual. Mostly they're rather fantastic dreams. But I've never dreamt about escaping since the war. And before the war, I often had dreams of escaping. But after Villers-Bocage, I never dreamt of escaping again.
Do you think that the treatment and provision of support for returning service personnel was adequate after the war?
Of the Italians?
Of British service personnel, with the support available to them, was it adequate, do you think?
For the British who had been prisoners?
Well, for everyone who had been serving.
I don't think we'd all thought to criticise it. We'd have rather well off compared to the civilians. People had a demob suit, and I had a demob hat, which I forgot on the train once. And a demob suit I sold very quickly to somebody else and put it into something nicer, a pullover or something. But we did have these things, and we had disembarkation leave with petrol, few petrol coupons. So I think that most people felt they were very well off, very well treated. And I don't think we were badly treated at all. What we needed was the government to have done something about the housing shortage. This was on a university level. It's certainly in the Cambridge area, it was very bad. London, of course, was... people were living too many in a house. But the doodlebug that hit our house totally destroyed. The 100 houses were recorded as totally destroyed. And I think the best part of 1,000 got some damage from it. A few odd windows broken and things. So that I think that the troops got very well looked after. I think it was unfortunate for certain groups that the merchant navy, I think some of them didn't get as good a service as they could have done. Actually, Anne could tell you more about that, really, probably, because she came across some of these things with when she was not at Hatfield, but after she moved to Oxford. And people were demobbed from there sometimes early. And they thought they ought to have had more. One did, anyway. But you must ask her about that, because there was a Czech who'd been parachuted twice into Czechoslovakia for MI5 or something, and got back. And he thought, when he heard some of the people grumbling, he said, "You don't know what it's like